Hi, I'm Chris Satula. Welcome to That's History, our regular segment where we look at current events and find echoes, parallels, and lessons from the past. I am joined, as always, by Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here, as always.
Well, they say there's nothing new under the sun, and to that cliche, we could include the topic of prisoner exchanges, which has been a hot topic in Washington and elsewhere recently, due to the exchange of Bo Bergdahl for five members of the Taliban. So as a history professor, looking at the furor that has occurred over this exchange, what comes to mind?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that we all need a little bit of a history primer, because at a moment like this, we have to remind ourselves that throughout our entire history, we've exchanged prisoners of war. There are any number of reasonable grounds that you can critique this exchange upon. You can say we paid too high a price. You can say that the White House mishandled the unveiling of the exchange. I think all that's perfectly legitimate, but it is illegitimate to say that there's something wrong with prisoner exchange because we've done it for a very long time, and I would argue for some very humane reasons.
Trace the history for us. It goes back to colonial times, or at least the Revolutionary War.
Yes. You may remember from your high school history textbooks that there were a lot of Americans in British prisons, and it wasn't pretty. Some of those prisons were ships. There was one in New York Harbor. There was one off the coast of South Carolina. And a lot of people died in them. Probably a third of the people that the British imprisoned, of the Americans, died. And so General Washington, later our president, corresponded frequently with General Howe and other British leaders, military leaders, to try to free or exchange as many of these people as possible.
Yet the tradition of one party on a side being unhappy to how another party on the same side has done the arithmetic of prisoner exchanges also began with General Washington.
Yes, it's always controversial. Washington didn't like the fact that state militias were often making their own deals with the Brits to spring their own men. So if you were a state militia and one of your guys gets captured by the Brits, you'd say, okay, I'll give you 100 prisoners for our guy because we need our guy back. And of course, Washington didn't like this because he thought that we were giving away the store. But there was very little he could do. This, of course, is before the Constitution. It's before really a nation. And so he has actually very little control over what the states are doing.
Rolling through the catalog of American wars, we come to the War of 1812. Then.
And in the War of 1812, there are two remarkable things that happen. The first is that the two sides actually make a system for exchange, which is called a cartel. And it has mathematical precision. It says things like, if you have an admiral and you want to get him back, you have to give us 60 enlisted guys. And it goes on like that. We think that both sides actually held to the cartel pretty well. The other important thing about the War of 1812, of course, is that the poem that becomes our national anthem is written by Francis Scott Key in Baltimore in a boat where he had gone to try to exchange American prisoners with Brits. He gets onto this boat to negotiate an exchange, and then, of course, the bombing of Fort McHenry begins, and he can't leave. Mm-hmm. And so he sits there and watches the bombing and writes the Star-Spangled Banner. But I think it's fascinating that our national anthem was written during a prisoner exchange.
Right. And also that explains some of the anxiety that he felt and then the relief that you get at the end of the anthem.
Precisely.
So we move on to the Civil War, where there were massive numbers of prisoners. There were massive armies confronting each other. And you have hundreds of thousands of prisoners on each side and several very notorious prisons, particularly the Confederacy's Andersonville prison, yet exchanges occur, or maybe because of that exchanges occur.
Indeed, because of that exchanges occur, but then they stop. Again, prison exchange is always complicated and controversial, and because race is never far from the surface in this country, it shouldn't surprise us that it became a controversy in the Civil War, specifically after signing on to a cartel with the North. The South announced in 1863 that it wouldn't exchange African-American prisoners. It either murdered them, which it did, we think, to the tune of hundreds, or it actually re-enslaved them. And so it gave up the prisoner exchange, and then we see the prison population swell, especially at places like Andersonville.
So during the Civil War, when exchanges were occurring up till about 1863, it also points to another one of the issues frequently made about this exchange and other more modern exchanges. One is that if you're releasing Taliban leaders or operatives, you're releasing them back to an active battlefield. But again, that is was the case in the Civil War and other times in the past.
Absolutely. And when Grant finally announced that he wasn't going to do any more exchanges, that was one of the things he said. Interestingly, his argument went like this. He said, because our prisons in the North are so much nicer than places like Andersonville, the people we release will be stronger and will do more harm to us ultimately as re-enlisted Confederate soldiers than the victims in places like Andersonville, many of whom were starving to death and would probably never re-enlist in the Union Army.
The other twist in this situation with the Taliban in what is essentially an undeclared war against a somewhat shadowy enemy is that you're talking about General Howe and General Washington negotiating. Well, these are two commanders of organized armies. Here you're talking about people who many consider not members of an army but terrorists. Does that change the equation at all?
Well, you know, I don't really think it does. I mean, one interesting way of thinking about the revolutionary analogy is that in a sense we, the Americans, were the disorganized one. It's true we had a general. His name was Washington. But as the very example of the exchanges by the state militias demonstrate, this general actually had very limited powers over his own army. Again, just so we don't get angry notes from our listeners, I'm not saying General Washington was in the Taliban. But I am saying that like the Taliban, his army was rather disorganized and his authority, like the authority of the people atop these, quote, shadowy groups in the Middle East, was fairly tenuous and unofficial.
And it is also true, I guess I'm going to about to get in trouble, that usually the designation of a rebellion against the established order, later on being called a war of liberation, a war of freedom, is basically a judgment by the victors. And the losers sometimes remain terrorists in the history books.
Right, without a doubt. Look, I mean, you look at the pictures of Bo Bergdahl in Afghanistan and he was really suffering. But I would suggest that those prison ships in New York Harbor where Americans had to languish were a lot worse than anything Bo Bergdahl probably faced. I mean, we think that a third of the people that went into one of those ships died in them and they'd be thrown overboard or just buried in shallow graves.
This has been That's History. We've been talking with Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University. A pleasure as always, Jonathan.
Thanks. It was fun.